Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Thursday. Feeling groovy. Jimmy Akins here. It's open forum. It's going to be a great show. Glad you're with us. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And as I said, our guest, Jimmy Akin, you know him. He's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many, many things, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and the man willing to take virtually any question you can throw at him. First of all, no requirements on Jimmy's part that you have any affiliations. You can be Catholic. You can be not Catholic. Christian, not Christian. What are some other possible affiliations? American, not American. Earthling, not Earthling. He'll talk to anybody about anything. 888-318-7884 is the number. Jimmy, how you doing?
Doing okay. How about you, Cy?
Quite well. Thank you for a Thursday.
Looking groovy today?
Yes, I am looking groovy today because I was wearing my sunglasses. They're not exactly sunglasses. They're like shaded glasses. And they said, wear them on the air.
I think that's what sunglasses are, is shaded glasses.
Well, they're okay. All right, Jimmy, you are correct. But these are slightly less shaded than your typical sunglasses,
I think. And they're not even a special kind of shaded ones. Like rose-colored glasses are shaded, but they're rose-tinted. Yeah. And there are those 3D glasses that they used to have where one is red and one is blue. I think aviators may use those too.
These are none of the above. These are those. Mm-hmm.
These are ordinary shaded glasses or sunglasses.
Well, they do have a special superpower. These are supposed to help you if you get migraine headaches. And so sometimes I wear them around the building, but the youngins all said, wear them on the show. So I'm wearing them, and I hope that they're not just playing a practical joke on me. I hope that I look as cool as you all said I looked before. Jimmy, tomorrow, big day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The world awaits. You know, the whole world waits on Fridays.
Yeah. Well, for Mysterious World,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
for the... Yeah. Going to be talking about the warning or illumination of consciences event that various mystics have discussed and looking into the evidence of some of the claims that people are making about it, like it's going to happen this year and whether or not such a claim and others are well-founded or not.
This is one I'm looking forward to. You know, I look forward to all of them, but some with more forwardness. And
sure.
Yeah, because so many people have been talking about this. All right. So that drops at 5 a.m.
Like 4:30 a.m. California time.
4:30 a.m. All right. I'll be up setting my alarm. Our number here is 888-318-7884. Already lines filling up as they do on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So let's go to James in Albany, New York. James, have you got a question for Jimmy Akin?
So my question is about participating in a secular wedding. Mm-hmm. So my wife and I are both practicing Catholics, and we were invited to a secular wedding of our good friends. One of them is a Catholic, lapsed but baptized, and mm-hmm. the other one is an unbaptized man. So mm-hmm. without thinking about it, we RSVP'd yes, so we were going to go. So originally, they had asked me to officiate, to which I said no, because as a Catholic, I can't officiate a non-Catholic ceremony for a Catholic, not dispensed to form. However, a couple days ago, I was asked to do a reading of my own choosing. And so I don't know if I'm able to participate in the ceremony or at this point even attend. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, this is a difficult situation. So as people may know, the Catholic Church requires that its own members either have a Catholic ceremony or get a dispensation from having a Catholic ceremony. And that's something that only applies to people who are members of the Catholic Church. So if two people who are not Catholic get married, they don't have to have a Catholic wedding. Non-Catholic weddings, including secular non-Catholic weddings, are perfectly fine as long as the parties involved are not Catholic. The way church law is presently written, and it's changed a bit over time, but the way it's presently written, if your friend who is a Catholic, even if she's lapsed, if she doesn't have a dispensation from form, then canon law is written such that the marriage would not be valid. And in the case of a non-valid marriage, I couldn't recommend participation because it merely one's presence at such an event can signify that you're validating the marriage. And so I personally would not recommend that. It's how to explain that to a friend, especially after one's RSVP'd, can be a delicate matter. You could always, explain it. I mean, you could explain it directly, and that might or might not have a good effect. Obviously, what you want to do is communicate with your friend in such a way that will best promote the spiritual good of the people. And that means not making Catholics look crazy for honoring their consciences. There are, a variety of options. I would suggest talking perhaps with a priest or spiritual counselor who could go into more detail than what we're able to do here on the air.
I hope that that is helpful to you. Thanks very much for the call, James. We go now to Gabriel in Houston, Texas. Gabriel, you there with us?
Yes.
Hello, Gabriel. How old are you?
9.
Well, it's very nice to get your call. Have you called before, Gabriel? Have you ever called before?
Yes.
I thought maybe you had. Well, we're happy to have you back. You're always welcome here. What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
What kind of angel was Lucifer before he became the devil?
Well, some people have suggested that Lucifer may have been a seraphim. Others have suggested he might be a cherubim, but the truth is we don't really know. We're never actually told what kind of angel the devil was, and so the honest answer is we really don't know. We have to leave that to God.
Okay, Gabriel?
Okay.
All right. Well, you're named after an angel too, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what kind of angel Gabriel is?
Archangel.
Well, Gabriel is often classified as an archangel, and there's an argument that can be made for that, but the truth is we are never told, and so we don't know for sure.
You're awful lucky to be named after Gabriel, though. That's a good one. Gabriel, I hope you'll call many more times. You're always welcome here. I got to keep moving, though. Lots of people on the lines. Up next is Mitch in La Crosse, Wisconsin, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Mitch, delighted to have you with us. Your question for Jimmy.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I've tried to call in before, but this is the first time I've actually gotten through. It's great to be able to talk to you guys. I'm a longtime listener. And my question for Jimmy Aiken has to do with the Second Vatican Council. So I have a friend who is very traditional, and I'm very traditional myself, but he doesn't believe that the Second Vatican Council is, like, binding. Like, he thinks that it's only pastoral, and that's mainly because of quotes by St. John the 23rd and St. Paul the 6th. So I was wondering if you could maybe explain that to me and explain whether it was pastoral or binding, like councils like Trent and Florence and Vatican I, and just how I could explain it to him that the council can't really just be dismissed as pastoral and therefore as having errors in it.
Okay.
Sure. So there are several distinctions here that need to be made. The first one is between something being pastoral and being doctrinal in nature. And when we say that something is pastoral, that means that it's involved with the implementation of doctrine for the Christian life. And so even in pastoral situations, there is doctrine involved. You know, if you go, for example, into the confessional and you are talking to the priest and he gives you pastoral counsel about what you should do, well, that involves doctrine. If he's doing his job, he should be giving you sound pastoral advice, meaning, principles for implementing, or advice about implementing the principles of the Christian faith. And so even when something is pastoral in its orientation, that's more a method of phrasing and application. And there are still underlying doctrines that are involved, like, you know, telling you avoid this sin or avoid that sin, or here's a technique that you could use to avoid sin, all of those being things you might hear in the confessional. So that's one point that needs to be made. A second point that needs to be made is that the pastorality of the Second Vatican Council doesn't mean that it doesn't discuss doctrine. It quite clearly does. There's doctrine all over the place if you actually read its documents. There is nothing that says this is a merely advisory document that doesn't have doctrinal implications. And some documents absolutely indicate that this contains doctrine. Some of them are even labeled dogmatic constitutions. There's the dogmatic constitution on the church or Lumen Gentium, and there's the dogmatic constitution on the Word of God, Dei Verbum. So it couldn't be more clear. It's right there in the superscription of the document. This is a dogmatic document in its nature. So that's one of the things that needs to be pointed out. Another distinction that needs to be made is between truth and error. Just because something is pastoral or doctrinal is a separate question than does it contain error. And the things that we know do not contain error are the things that the church has not taught, are the things that the church has taught infallibly. However, the Second Vatican Council chose not to teach anything new infallibly. But that doesn't mean it can be disregarded, because even non-infallible things are authoritative if they're backed up by authority. You can't simply look at church teaching and say, oh, this point hasn't been infallibly defined, so I can just ignore it or treat it like an error. You cannot do that, because the Holy Spirit guides the church even when the church is not teaching infallibly. And so as a result, we have to take the church's teaching seriously, even when they're non-infallible. And this is something that would not have been controversial before Vatican II. People before Vatican II, people who are very traditional, should recognize this principle that even non-infallible church teachings cannot simply be dismissed. They're still guided by the Holy Spirit, and so they're still authoritative, even though we don't have the guarantee that they're infallible. Furthermore, the bishops of the world, who are guided by the Holy Spirit as a body, signed off on this council, as did the Pope. You had overwhelming support among the bishops and by the Pope for the documents of Vatican II. And so consequently, even though they're not infallible, they are vouched for by the magisterium of the time. And it was the magisterium that vouched for the Council of Trent. It was the magisterium that vouched for Florence. It was the magisterium that vouched for Vatican I and for Nicaea and Constantinople and all of the other church councils. So the basis of the authority of Vatican II is the same as the basis of authority for every other council. And if you can't dismiss other councils because they're vouched for by the magisterium, you can't dismiss this council because it's vouched for by the magisterium. Now, your friend may have some additional questions about particular points in Vatican II, but in terms of the overall council, it cannot be dismissed on the grounds that it is a so-called pastoral council, because it does teach doctrine and sometimes even explicitly flags documents as dogmatic in nature. And also it can't be dismissed because the basis of the council's authority is the same as that for other councils. It's the magisterium as guided by the Holy Spirit.
Mitch, I hope that was helpful. I really appreciate the question. People have actually been talking. It just seems like there's so much conversation about the Second Vatican Council in recent months. And some of it maybe pervasively kind of suspicious or negative. And so we're actually going to do a full hour with Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio just on the Second Vatican Council coming up. I'll see if I can find the date on that. I don't have it with me right now. We got to take a quick break, though. Thanks again for the call, Mitch. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this. Exorcisms on Monday and Rapture on Wednesday. That's the calendar this week on Catholic Answers Focus. The official exorcist of the Archdiocese of Indianapolis joins us on Monday to discuss the life of an exorcist, what training he gets, and then some stuff that's probably too scary to mention here. Then on Wednesday, we ask Carlo Broussard about the end times, particularly the rapture. Is there any chance that rapture might be real? Catholic Answers Focus is available on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Get all the details and past shows at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Now there's a fast and easy way to get in touch with EWTN. The EWTN Everything Number. Call 1-800-447-EWTN to get the latest information on programming, special events, pilgrimages, and more. Our EWTN Family Viewer Services representatives are ready to help you with whatever your needs may be. The EWTN Everything Number. 1-800-447-EWTN. EWTN.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
That big Vatican II show that we're going to do with Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio will be the 19th of October. That's a Monday, a couple Mondays from now this month. Right now, store-wide sale is on. I almost said store-wide summer sale. I have to pay Nick a dollar if I say summer sale at any time this year because I said it so many times last fall. If you're looking for killer deals on great Catholic books, DVDs, CVDs, CDs, and a whole bunch more, you just go over to shop.catholic.com. Stuff's on sale 10 to 25% off. Other stuff even more than 25% off, up to 50% off. That includes our School of Apologetics courses. So head on over now to shop.catholic.com and get your deals. Lines staying full. I feel like I say that every Tuesday and Thursday now. The lines just stay full, and we're grateful for it, but I got to keep moving. So Christopher, right here in California, watching on Facebook Live, you are next, Christopher. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
As I'm actually more listening to you on the phone right now, but no, even though I just got a glimpse of you on Facebook, just a little like second, like a little.
No, I got you. Like, yeah,
I want to know Jimmy Akin's opinion. Like, does he believe that Protestantism leads to atheism?
I've heard people suggest that, and personally, I would challenge that on a couple of grounds. The first one is, where's the evidence? Now, people may note historically that after the Reformation, we got not only a divided Europe where we had, Catholic areas and Protestant areas, but also we got a period known as the Enlightenment, which gave birth to movements where people were identifying as deists. And then later, some people were publicly identifying themselves as atheists. And so I presume that they would be appealing to this kind of historical evidence. The problem is that what we're talking about is a fracturing of society that occurred at the time of the Reformation. And when a society fractures, that has all kinds of unintended consequences that are not what either group was envisioning, and that can go off in unpredictable directions. And so consequently, I could say there might be some justification for saying if you have a society that has a particular faith, and then that society becomes religiously fractured, that some people may question religion altogether and say, well, maybe I should give up religion altogether. But that's not unique to Christianity and the division between Catholics and Protestants. You could imagine a society, let's say it's a Muslim society, and let's say it's initially Shiite, but then it becomes fractured so that you have a bunch of Sunnis and also Shiites, and some people may feel caught in the middle and, well, I don't know whether the Shiites or the Sunnis are correct, and so I'm just going to give up Islam altogether and become an atheist. Or you can imagine the same thing happening in a Jewish society or a Hindu society or a Shinto society or a Greco-Roman society or an Egyptian society or any society you want with any religion you want. I think you could appeal to this historical evidence as religious fractures in a society can lead to atheism. But I don't think you can say that this is something unique to Protestantism. So I would resist it on those grounds. I would challenge it on those grounds. I'd also challenge it on another ground, which is, does it actually help us to propose this? Actually, if you go around and let's say you tell a Protestant, you know, your position leads to atheism, they're probably going to dig in their heels. Because that's what happens when you make a really aggressive attack on someone else's position. And most Protestants would regard this as an aggressive attack on their position. And consequently, they're likely to dig in their heels. They're likely to view you as some kind of fanatic or at least wildly misguided person. I think the old saying is true. You win more people over if you're nice to them than if you're not. And going to someone and making historically problematic claims like Protestantism leads to atheism is going to offend more people. It's going to add heat rather than light. And it would be better to help draw people closer to the fullness of the truth without making such dramatic claims, however macho it may make some people feel to make claims like that.
Christopher, thank you for the call. It's nice to hear from you again. You're always welcome here, of course. But man, those lines are full. I'm going to keep moving. Rick in Bloomington, Indiana, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Rick, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, yeah. Thanks. Well, to that previous caller, sometimes Protestantism leads to Catholicism. That's my story. I'm in the UK right now.
Wonderful.
Yeah, the further I got into the Bible, the further I saw Catholic truth. Another good reason. So in John chapter 17, when Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he prays that that those who would believe by the disciples' word be one, just as He is one with the Father, so that the world might believe that the Father sent him. I read that as a Protestant, and I felt super guilty, and it was sad. I heard a joke. Well, you know, it's so impossible that, you know, God himself prays for it. And that just made me even more sad. So one of the strengths I saw in Catholicism was its unity, right? And so now that the more I look into Catholicism, the more splintered that I see it actually is. I'm in the RCIA. I mean, you have your traditionalists, you have your Medjugorje, Marian apparition believers. You have
I'm sure the list can go on and on. So, am I getting the idea that your question for Jimmy is about where or when are you going to see just a stable whole church the way that Jesus intended? Am I in the ballpark?
Yeah, you're in the ballpark. It's terribly confusing for people coming into the church.
Yeah. Fair enough. Jimmy?
So one of the things to be said here is that we're not going to see perfect unity among people until the second coming when God sorts us all out. Even in the first century, there was a danger of factionalism and schisms and even heresies because of the fallenness of human nature. And we see the New Testament authors themselves discussing these problems. St. Paul, for example, warns the Corinthians against factionalism. That's a key thing in 1 Corinthians. We also have warnings about people who will not put up with sound doctrine, who are heretics, or people who are deficient in love and form schisms. So this is something that has been with the church down through the ages. Now, having said that, I think that we have to set reasonable expectations for what kind of unity are we going to see in different areas. And I also think that we have to be reasonable in our apologetics regarding this issue. On the one hand, I think that there are Catholic apologists who overly stress the diversity of views in Protestantism and under stress the diversity of views in Catholicism. So they make it sound like all Catholics are united and all Protestants are not. And that's a caricature. That's not accurate. On the other hand, you will find people who are Protestant apologists who will say, well, no, we're Protestants united, at least when it comes to the essentials, and you're just as fragmented, you Catholics are just as fragmented as we are. And that's not accurate either. So when we come back on the other side of the break, I'll talk about a more accurate presentation.
Jimmy Akin, our guest, thanks very much for the question, Rick. We will continue that when we come back. I encourage you to call, but you might have to try a few times today because the lines are staying very, very full. 888-31-TRUTH.
Your questions, Catholic answers, live.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
How can a human woman be God's mother? Where in the Bible does it say that Mary was sinless and a perpetual virgin? What can I do to build and deepen my relationship with Mary as my spiritual mother in heaven? In 20 Answers Mary, you'll find biblical evidence for Marian doctrine and devotion, answers to common objections to Catholic teachings about Mary, and guidance on how to imitate Christ as you get to know the Blessed Mother like you've never known her before. 20 Answers Mary is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
We're called to live a life of detachment. We'll discuss this tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It is Groovy Music Thursday. Open forum all day today. Jimmy Akin with us both hours. So that's a lot of good stuff stacked up. You're welcome to call if you've got a question. 888-318-7884. We're talking right now with Rick in Bloomington, Indiana, about Rick's coming into the church, but finding that the church, in many ways, the Catholic Church, looks just as splintered as the many Protestant communities. So, Jimmy, you were in the midst of kind of responding to that.
Yeah, so I think it's a mistake when Catholic apologists make it sound like we Catholics are just fine because we've got unity, whereas Protestants are disunified. And I also think it's a mistake for Protestant apologists to say we Protestants are just fine because we agree on essentials and you Catholics are just as disunified as we are. I don't think either one of those is accurate. The truth is, human nature leads to disunity in its fallen state. And so there is a problem with disunity in both camps. And we need to be honest about that. It's a problem when Catholics are disunited on things that they need to be united about. And it's a problem when Protestants are disunited about things on which they need to be united about. And so that's just a part of living in the fallen human condition. Having said that, if we want to form an accurate appraisal of how much disunity there is in different groups, we need to do a number of things. The first one is we need to set aside the category of people who are not intellectually engaged in their faith. Because, you know, if someone never darkens a church door, it doesn't matter whether they're a Catholic or a Protestant, they're not going to be educated in their faith. And so consequently, you shouldn't be looking at those people as representative members of the community. For people who are representative Catholics or representative Protestants, you need to look at people who actually are engaged with their faith on an intellectual level so that they're actually interested in its teachings. Well, when you do that, a lot of the diversity actually goes away in both communities, because the people who are intellectually engaged with their faith do, in fact, tend to reflect the teachings of their church more. Another thing that we need to set aside are differences that are not consequential or that are part of legitimate diversity. For example, it wouldn't be accurate, and I have heard some Protestants say things like this, but it would not be accurate to look at the Catholic Church and say, oh, look at all these different groups you've got, like Franciscans and Dominicans and Jesuits. What disunity? Well, that's a mistake, because those are different religious orders. Christ never said all of your religious figures need to belong to the same order, and they all need to have the same charism and the same spirituality. You look at the New Testament, you see people who are in communion with each other, like Peter, James, and Paul. They each had different personalities. They each had different spiritualities, but they were in union with each other when it came to the Christian faith. And so we shouldn't expect everybody to have the same spirituality. And that applies to things like Marian apparitions and do you like the Latin Mass or not? Those are different spiritualities. Some people have a more Marian spirituality. Some people have a more Tridentine spirituality. Some people have a more Chaldean spirituality. And so we shouldn't expect people to all have the same spirituality. That's not an impermissible form of diversity. That's actually something that's willed by Christ. And as Paul says, you know, in Romans 12 and in 1 Corinthians 12, the Spirit gives us different gifts. So we're naturally going to have somewhat different spiritualities, and that's not a sign of disunity. So I would set aside the fact that, you know, well, some people like the Latin Mass and some people are really into Marian apparitions. That's not illegitimate at all. It can become illegitimate, just like anything can become illegitimate if you start saying it's my way or the highway. Everybody needs to be like this. But at that point, you're going beyond merely preferring the Latin Mass or being really into Marian apparitions. You're doing something beyond what the church actually says. So if we then look at having made those, and the same thing applies in Protestant groups, you know, one wouldn't say that there's disunity because some churches use electric guitars and some Protestant churches use organs. You know, that's a matter of style and spirituality. That's not a matter of substance. So we need to apply the same thing on both sides of the aisle. So once we eliminate looking at people who don't take their faith seriously, and once we eliminate matters of style and spirituality and we start looking at matters of substance, what do we find? Well, we do find that there are people in both communities who reject the teaching of their church. So you will find Catholics who reject various Catholic doctrines. You will find Protestants in Protestant churches who reject various doctrines that are taught by their churches. But, and here's a difference, you will find much more diversity in Protestant churches than you will find in Catholic churches. Because at least in the Catholic Church, you have a single voice, which Catholics hold to be guided by God and the Holy Spirit. You have a single voice saying, this is definitely what Christ teaches. So, for example, in the Catholic Church, if you look at the sacrament of baptism and you ask the question, does baptism impart saving grace? The answer is yes. There's no debate about that. There's no legitimate debate about that, because that's something that the church has definitively taught. And consequently, most Catholics who may dissent on other matters are going to agree to that. They'll at least say, oh, sure, baptism gives grace. You look at the Protestant community, you will not find unity on that point. You will find some Protestant churches that say, yes, baptism gives grace. You will find other Protestant churches that say, no, it definitely does not. And you will find other Protestant churches that leave the matter ambiguous. Well, since baptism is the Christian initiation ritual, this is a pretty important point. And it would be important to know, does baptism actually give grace or not? Well, you find a kind and a level of unity among Catholics on that you do not find among Protestants. And the same applies across the board on other theological issues. You find much more unity among Catholics, and especially among Orthodox Catholics, than you do among Protestants, because their churches teach different things. And it's much more optional what you believe in a given Protestant church. And so I think there, even though I resist inaccurate, overly simplistic comparisons between the Protestant and the Catholic Church when it comes to unity, I think there is a kind of unity that is greater in both kind and degree in the Catholic Church compared to what you find in the Protestant community.
Rick, I hope you find that helpful and encouraging. Thank you very much for your call. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're going to go to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Back to EWTN, Channel 130, Sirius XM, Satellite Radio. John, in Allentown, your question for Jimmy. Hi, John. All right, I'm coming back to you, John. That's all right. Something's up with John. We'll go to Emma in Hayden, Idaho. Emma, you're usually there when I go to you. Are you there, Emma?
I'm here.
Hi, Emma. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi.
And who's that with you?
I called Kat Veda, my granddaughter.
Your granddaughter. Okay, very nice. Nice to hear from her, too.
Oh, my. Yeah, there you go. So I called last week, and Jimmy didn't have time for my second question. And
what's your question?
I've been listening to you guys for 4 years. For mm-hmm. 2.5, 3 years, I've been praying to step over the line and leave my Protestant faith. I've been to Mass a few times. I miss the worship service. I go to my church. I don't feel right there. Still struggling with the whole Mary thing. I'm getting emotional, sorry. And
okay.
I'm frustrated. I'm at my wit's end, and I'm frustrated.
So would you like some direction from Jimmy about what to do next?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So, I understand this. I've been there myself. I'm a convert myself. I know what it's like to feel torn between the two communities. What I did was I made a list. I said, okay, what are the issues that I need to consider in becoming Catholic or remaining Protestant? And I specifically said, which are the ones that are crucial? Things like, do I prefer this style of worship or that style of worship? That's not crucial, because God cares about the fact you're worshiping Him in spirit and truth. He doesn't care whether you're using an organ or whether you're using electric guitars or things like that. It's not about matters of style. It's about matters of substance. And so even if something in the Catholic community feels different or strange to me, or I'm not entirely comfortable with it, at least not yet, that's okay. I don't have to be comfortable with everything. God asks us to do things that are uncomfortable at times. So I said, what's really important? What really do I need to sort out? And those are the things that are either true or false. If ultimately the Catholic faith is true, then I need to be Catholic. Whatever else is the case, however I feel about it, it doesn't really matter. If the Catholic faith is true, then I need to be Catholic. If it's not true, well, then I shouldn't be Catholic. And so I made a list of the doctrinal points that you know, were relevant in my case, and said, I'm going to work through them with an open mind, one by one. And so when I did, I realized that the evidence pointed towards the Catholic Church. Now, that didn't mean I could prove every single point from the Catholic perspective, but I saw that, you know, treating these with an open mind, the evidence strongly supports the Catholic position, and I don't have any ones where I can say the Catholic Church is just flat wrong. So I will go with the Catholic Church because that's where the evidence is pointing me. And so if you're feeling at kind of an impasse in your spiritual journey, Emma, I would encourage you to do the same thing. Take a look at the doctrinal matters that separate you from the Catholic Church presently, and then start studying those matters. We have a lot of resources at Catholic.com, thousands that are available for free for some more in-depth stuff. We also have some stuff you can purchase. We're here to answer questions live on the phone for free on Catholic Answers Live. So we're here to help you work through those issues, whatever they may be. You mentioned Mary. There may be other ones. But the fundamental orientation that I would suggest is work through the issues step by step and be open-minded and focus on what's true rather than what one's feelings are. At least that's the strategy that worked for me.
Emma, thank you. We have to take a break, and we'll do that. And John in Allentown, I know you're there now, so we're going to come back to you when we come back right after this.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
St. Hildegard of Bingen was a mystic, an abbess, a botanist, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Hildegard had her first visions at the age of three, which she called the shade of the living light. She later wrote about them in works declared by St. Bernard of Clairvaux to be from God. Pope Benedict XVI agreed when he named her only one of four Doctors of the Church who are women in 2012.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and senior apologist here, and the author of many books, including the recent, very popular book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. We've given a lot of those away, as a matter of fact, as people call regularly with questions about the Bible, and we can highly recommend that. Jimmy's got a couple more coming out soon, including one we hope will come out before Christmas, which is...
two coming out before Christmas.
And you think they'll both be out before Christmas? Okay.
Yeah, that's the plan. And, that's what I'm told.
And the one that I was thinking of was the one that is kind of a... not a long book, but a book that's shorter, easier to read, but also involves an invitation to come to the faith, come to the Catholic Church. And
yeah, either come to or come back to.
Yeah. All right. We'll let everybody know when that one is out. John in Allentown, Pennsylvania, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You there with us, John?
Yes, I am.
Hi, John.
Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
Hi. Hey, I was talking to this friend of mine who's a Messianic Jew, and he hit me with three things that I just never heard. Could I ask like three real fast questions?
Why don't we do one today, and you can call back for additional questions?
Okay. I guess the first one the one that he got me on that I thought was the weirdest one is he said that nobody is in heaven. That we all go to the grave, and then when Jesus comes back, he will take people that are righteous to heaven.
Okay.
Okay. So the view that he's expressing, I can't be 100% sure since he's not here for me to confirm this with. But in the Old Testament, there is a term that's used to refer to where dead people go. And this term is Sheol. Now, you'll hear some people mispronounce it as Sheol, but it's not. In Hebrew, it's Sheol. And this term is often translated grave, and that's a legitimate translation. It also can refer more broadly to the place of the dead. And it was generally envisioned as being, you know, underground, because that's where you put dead bodies, either in caves or otherwise bury them. And so, there is a sense in which this is a legitimate viewpoint. People do die. They do go to the grave. And prior to the time of Christ, they would remain in this state. Unless they were an exceptional person like Enoch or Elijah, they wouldn't be taken to heaven. So most people went to Sheol, and they waited there. But then when Jesus died and rose again, that situation changed. Jesus went to heaven. And so Jesus is in heaven. And the New Testament authors indicate that when Jesus went to heaven, he took other people there. They portray him as leading a triumphal parade of souls into heaven. And now the expectation for people who die in God's friendship after the coming of Christ is that they go to heaven. And we can see this from a variety of passages. If you look, for example, at Philippians 1, verses 23 and following, St. Paul is talking to the Philippians about how he is in a delicate legal situation, and even though he thinks he's going to get through the situation okay, he might be put to death for his faith at this time. And he actually says he feels kind of torn between the two options, because on the one hand, he'd like to stay and continue his ministry on earth and help the, for example, the Philippians more. But on the other hand, he'd like to die and go be with Jesus. And since we know Jesus is in heaven, if Paul dies and goes to be with Jesus, that means Paul is going to be in heaven as well. And so this is not something that he's saying is, well, only when Jesus comes back will that happen. No, he's expecting this as an imminent thing. If he dies right now, he's going to go to heaven. Similarly, if you look in the book of Revelation, you know, when John sees the activities that are going on in heaven, he sees the souls under the altar in heaven crying out to God for justice. So they're in heaven, they're under the heavenly altar, and they're clearly conscious and talking to God. We also have another scene in Revelation where John sees a group of people coming up in white robes from the earth, and a heavenly figure says, "Who are these people?" And he says, "Oh, you know that. I mean, you tell me." And he says, "Well, these are the souls of those who have been martyred on earth." So martyrs from earth are having their souls go up into heaven and be on the heavenly scene. So your friend's position, even though I understand some of where it may come from, doesn't reflect what the New Testament says about the situation after the coming of Christ.
When I call back, I'll have some other questions about that.
Okay, good. Okay. But you got a good answer on that one. I think you're ready to go. Thanks, John. I appreciate that very much. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Open Forum. We'll go down to Florida. Watching on YouTube Live is Edward. Edward, hang on a quick sec. Let me get to the right button. Edward, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello?
Hi, Edward. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. My question is in terms of Constantine. What was his relationship with the church, and was he a true Christian?
Well, his relationship with the church varied over the course of his life. Prior to his conversion, he was a pagan, and then he adopted Christian views and held them for many years, even though he wasn't yet baptized. And then towards the end of his life, he was baptized, and that was not uncommon. In his day, people would sometimes delay baptism until they saw death was approaching. And so he had basically three phases of his life. The first phase where he was a pagan, the second phase where he was a Christian intellectually, but not yet sacramentally, and then the third phase where he was a Christian sacramentally. Was he sincere in his faith? Yes. We have no evidence that he was like just faking this. He really was a believer. That doesn't mean he was a perfect believer. He had a bunch of pagan subjects, and consequently, he not everybody just became Christian when Constantine did, and so he had some delicate balancing acts about, well, what is he going to allow the pagans to do? Even now that he's announced we're gonna approve of Christians, what about all these pagans? They want to, you know, build their temples. How do I maintain this delicate balance with these different groups? And various things that he did could be viewed as compromises with paganism that certainly later Christian rulers that had a Christian populace wouldn't have had to make. And so you could look at some of the compromises he made to deal with his pagan subjects and say, you know, he wasn't a perfect Christian, but you know what? None of them are. Ultimately, what tells us where his heart was is how he wanted to die. And how he wanted to die was as a Christian, which is why he got baptized shortly before his death.
Edward, thanks. Going to keep moving, trying to get everybody in here if I can. Tene in Maryland watching on YouTube Live. You are next. Tene, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, I just wanted to ask about mental health. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And if I was being 100% honest, I think it has the largest effect on my faith. Like, my faith will go soaring, like I feel like I could be a martyr, and then my faith will go down, so like I feel like doomed or something.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So your question, so you've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and so you, as you're in the more manic side, you feel a sense of a stronger faith. What's the question for Jimmy?
So, like, how does God do that? Like, am I, like, accountable when I'm depressed? Or, like, how does, like, can I get healing? Or, like, what should I do? I'm on medication.
Okay.
Okay.
It's good you're on medication, yeah.
It's good you're on medication. It is good that you stay on the medication, even if you feel like you don't need it, or even if you feel like it's not helping. It's still important that you stay on the medication. A lot of the medications, like, for example, lithium for bipolar people, don't really affect you when you're at a high or a low, but they will diminish the highs and lows if you stay on them regularly. And so it's important to stay on the medication. Could God miraculously heal you of this, or at least make it better supernaturally? Yes, that's possible. When you're at a high or a low, you might consider receiving the sacrament of the anointing of the sick. And if it's God's will, he might do something special to help you at that time. Also, you can always pray for healing, but be aware it's not always God's will that we be healed of diseases. If it were, then nobody would ever die. Because whenever we get a fatal illness, people would just pray and we wouldn't die. So it's not always God's will that we be healed of an illness. What I would suggest is taking this illness and offering it up to God and saying, God, please give me the grace to deal with this illness and help other people through what I go through. If I please you with how I handle this, then please bless me and those I care about, and even the whole world. You know, we can often offer up our sufferings for everyone in the world and ask God to bless them if we deal with these sufferings in a way that pleases God. In terms of accountability, obviously, when we're accountable for what we do in a normal mental state, and to the extent that we have psychological forces pulling us away from that normal mental state, we are less accountable in those situations.
Tene, I feel like we rushed your question a bit. I hope we got to what you wanted. I did that just because we were coming up at the top of the hour. You are always welcome to call back. I hope that was helpful for you. We do have to head out to a break right now, however. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and he will be our guest next hour as well. So if you have a question, there are two lines open right now. Go ahead and dial 888-318-7884. And if you're already on the line, hang on the line. Got another hour with Jimmy Akin. Open forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.